It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Yesterday, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump called for a complete ban on Muslims entering the United States. It would apply to immigrants as well as visitors.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
Trump's critics called his proposal a ratcheting up of the rhetoric aimed at Americans' fears about members of the Islamic faith. His proposal comes a day after President Obama spoke to the nation in the wake of the killing of 14 people in San Bernardino by a man and woman reported to be ISIS supporters. Days before that tragic event took place, Pittsburgh Muslim leader Safdar Khwaja published an op-ed piece in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette entitled, "They Are Not a State. They are Daesh," calling on everyone to join the fight to defeat the killers he says masquerade as believers. Safdar Khwaja is president of the Pittsburgh chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, the largest Muslim civil rights and advocacy organization in the United States. He joins us in studio. Safdar Khwaja, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you for inviting me. It's an unfortunate time, but a good opportunity to be on your show.
And it's certainly a pleasure having you. We will take your questions and comments at 412-246-2002 as we go along in the program. But I wanted to begin with the obvious news that much of America is reacting to today, and that is Donald Trump's plan to block all Muslims from entering the United States. What is your reaction to this proposal by the man who is leading in the polls for the Republican presidential nomination?
Well, Paul, I saw the thing live from Charleston, South Carolina, and it seemed like a horror show. I could not believe that in modern-day America somebody could talk like this. A number of websites compared his talk to Mussolini, for example, espousing fascism. He used a number of either hateful or phobic ideas to form his statements. And most significantly, he read out a poll that was supposedly conducted by a center for security studies. I looked that up. That is a hate group. And if you look at their websites, they have all this material about fear-mongering and demonizing, etc. Now, this poll was conducted online anonymously, so you don't even know that the people who were responding were actually Muslims. So the scientific integrity of such a poll diminishes right away. And then there were many questions that were asked, which were responded to. He only chose a couple of specific ones, and he did this repeatedly in a very articulated fashion to rile up the crowd, which was very sad, by the way. And he mentioned these people, they want Sharia, and it looks like, based on what Ben Carson has been saying, and what Donald Trump also mentioned from these hate groups, that Sharia has become a bugaboo. And there needs to be an understanding of what this really is, because it just cannot be used as a bugaboo or something to be feared of, like a huge monster or ghost coming to out of a Hitchcock movie that will scare everybody. So I was glad that the other Republican candidates very immediately refuted what Trump was saying or doing, and also that this was not American. These are not American values. We cherish our values, and we cherish our civilized society based on intelligence, based on full knowledge, based on a deep understanding of things, and then we take action. We don't take actions in a complete reaction by jumping off a high point without knowing why we are jumping, why we are taking the action, and who we are taking the action against.
Donald Trump, and he's not the first one to say this, has previously called for surveillance against mosques and that he was open to establishing a database for all Muslims living in the United States. It's almost a suggestion of a virtual, if you will, virtual internment of Muslims, unlike the actual physical internment of Japanese Americans. Mm-hmm. Immediately following the attack on Pearl Harbor, that this is a way of marginalizing Muslim Americans. How does this make you feel as a Muslim American?
Again, what he's saying is very un-American, and he's saying it out of complete ignorance. Muslims have been here on this continent since the times of Columbus. Columbus's navigators were Muslims. A large number of very intelligent people who came from Spain with Columbus were Muslims. The large number of people who were forcibly kidnapped from Africa and brought over to work on plantations in the Americas, a good number of them were Muslims. Alex Haley's famous book that was subject of a movie, Roots. Kunta Kinte, who was a star of his book, was a Muslim from Gambia. And a substantial portion, more than 40% of the Muslim population in America is black Americans, people who have origins centuries ago from Africa. They are part of America. They are part of the American mosaic. Muslims have been coming in the third wave on this continent since the Industrial Age, from the Eastern European region and the Middle Eastern region. There have been people here in Pittsburgh, Muslims who've been here for more than a century. There are mosques in Pittsburgh that have existed from the early part of the 20th century. The mosque in Oakland, which was recently visited by the larger community, has been in existence for over 40 years. That is over four decades. The Muslim Community Center in Monroeville that I belong to has existed for close to 30 years now. That's three decades. We were not having these issues midway through the 20th century, in the later part of the 20th century. This phenomenon is very, very recent, that we have all this rhetoric coming from overseas, where ISIS or Daesh has taken this Frankenstein form. And so Mr. Trump is reacting, and with I would say essentially with ignorance, that the entire population of Muslims, whether they've been here for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100, or 500 years, they should all be suspects, and they should all wear tags, and they should all be part of a database. This would be hilarious if this was not so sickening and so dangerous to the fabric of American society. He and Ben Carson are tearing at the fabric of American society, which is something that all civilized citizens just should not allow.
I was talking at the outset about an incident in Philadelphia. A severed pig's head was discovered in front of a Philadelphia mosque. And around the country, there have been different forms of a backlash against Muslim Americans. How would you describe the backlash, if any, against Muslims in Pittsburgh?
Pittsburgh has been very fortunate. I myself have been in Pittsburgh for in excess of 35 years continuously. It has been an island of calm and understanding in I would not say an ocean, but in a lot of incidents we get from Texas, Virginia, Kansas, etc., Oklahoma, Arizona, where hate groups prevail. Pittsburgh has been remarkably good, and the credit goes to the work ethic and the understanding nature of the community, the hardworking nature of the community. So the credit goes to them that they have not been influenced by the hate rhetoric. The Thanksgiving Day taxi cab driver shooting sort of burst the bubble of a lot of people.
And let me just get people up to speed on that. That was in the Hazelwood area, and it was a shooting incident involving a Muslim immigrant cab driver that you're referring to. So I'll let you continue.
Exactly, yeah. There's a Moroccan immigrant who's been here in Pittsburgh for over 5 years, and he's close to his citizenship. Yeah, he was shot by his passenger on the early morning of Thanksgiving Day. Prior to that, the incidents were random. There would be somebody who would hurl an insult at someone who was apparently looking like a, you know, stereotypical Muslim. Some school children would taunt Muslim kids with, you know, attributions or similarities with some terrorist organizations. In a number of cases, the Council on American Islamic Relations went into different school districts to talk to them, to talk to the teaching staffs, and give them more information so their awareness becomes more complete, because there are a lot of hate groups. There's so-called an industry of propagating hate against Islam primarily. And they affect people. If TV channels show some of the material that they put out, and if people don't do independent reading, if they don't do independent analysis, if they don't know a Muslim personally, and consequently, if they don't understand what Islam really is, they're liable to end up believing whatever they see in a short soundbite or a short snippet, a ticker going across the bottom of a TV screen. But Pittsburgh, we have been very fortunate. The community has been very, very civilized, very intellectually competent, and has been able to differentiate between the good and the bad.
And there was a press conference held over the weekend involving Pittsburgh Police Chief Cameron McClay, in which a joint commitment was announced between the Islamic Center of Pittsburgh and Pittsburgh Police to work collaboratively to improve trust and communication in the wake of that shooting incident. How is this helping to reassure the Muslim community in Pittsburgh? I know you attended that event. How is that helping?
That is helping substantially. It is a move in the right direction. I give a lot of credit to the police chief. He showed leadership, and he showed the full responsibility that a police chief needs to have. And he made commitments, and he's sincere. And that is very heartwarming for the community because they're concerned about safety of mosques. There have been 30-odd incidents in other cities, but not in Pittsburgh, about vandalizing of mosques and people throwing things and breaking windows and writing sad graffiti. I also basically commend the mayor's office because they also stepped in, and they're taking actions. Mayor Peduto's office has been extremely good at outreach. And they're extremely good with all minorities. And that is very important to build the social structure, enhance the social fabric of the city. The biggest thing that impressed me at that press conference was the large number of faith groups that came to that press conference. The Pennsylvania Interfaith Impact Network was present. One of their leaders, Pastor Kolb, he spoke very positively, very reassuringly for the entire community that we are together in solving our problems. People came out on a holiday to be present at that time. So, I mean, there are indeed problems, as we will discuss later on. And we have to work together to identify them scientifically, smartly, and come up with smart solutions. That is how those problems will go away. They will not go away by an extreme reaction of something, you know, a fear of something that you don't know about.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and my guest is Safdar Khwaja. He is president of the Pittsburgh chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations, the largest Muslim civil rights and advocacy organization in the United States. Talking about recent events, the comments by Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump calling for a complete ban on Muslims entering the United States in the wake of the shooting incident and the killings last week in San Bernardino, California. And our guest is the author of a Post-Gazette piece entitled "They Are Not a State, They Are Daesh," calling on everyone to join the fight to defeat the killers, he says, masquerade as believers. That was an op-ed piece that appeared in the Post-Gazette actually days before the incident in San Bernardino. And in your piece, Softar, you point out that the ISIS interpretations of Islam have been roundly refuted by Islamic scholars around the world, and that ISIS followers are neither Islamic nor are they a state. Explain how the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or ISIS as we know it, is perverting what it means to be Muslim.
Yes. The first thing to look at is the letter that was written, open letter that was written to the so-called leader of the ISIS. Your listeners can go to www.lettertobaghdadi.com. Lettertobaghdadi.com. It's a very long letter. It has a one-page executive summary of all the points that ISIS espouses. And then there is a multi-page document very clearly delineating all the corruption in their interpretations, all the deviant natures of their interpretations, and a refutation of each one of their interpretations. There was initially last year 120-odd worldwide scholars and Muslim leaders had signed that letter. The number stands at about 145 right now worldwide. That is a start. And I'll give you a few of those examples because there are dozens of them and they're very long and convoluted. There are certain Islamic concepts that are immutable. For example, the preciousness of human life. An innocent person, an unarmed person, a non-combatant, all of those categories, you cannot touch their lives. If you kill one person, you've essentially killed all of humanity. The magnitude of that crime is so large. Now, when I say immutable, that means no other interpretation in any other context can override or abrogate the very fundamental concept that innocent life is totally precious and is sanctimonious. So therein lies the very first deviation that ISIS makes. And in fact, if you take that away from them, their entire structure collapses. Their entire structure of the rest of their interpretations, basically the house of cards falls down. Then there are some secondary ones. For example, killing of prisoners. They cite some ancient precedent, which is unverified and incomplete, that was certain prisoners after a certain war were executed. What they forget is to read the entire discourse. Yes, there was at least one war in which hundreds of people were taken prisoners, and a few of the prisoners were charged with treason. They were tried in an open court with their own peers. Importantly, it was not a kangaroo court type situation. With their own elders and own peers, okay, you determine whether these people committed treason. After they were tried with their own peers in just sitting in judgment, and then only those people were punished, not the rest of the prisoners, which was a large majority of the prisoners. A prisoner's life is sanctimonious. Because once the person has been taken into your custody, it is now a trust. These are very serious things. They cannot be treated lightly. That person is now your trust. You cannot abuse the person. You cannot torture the person. You certainly cannot take the person's life. It is a trust with you. So, and there's a whole host of things.
So what you're saying is that what those who espouse to ISIS are doing and what members of ISIS are doing is violating the basic tenets of Islam.
Absolutely, yeah, the basic tenets.
412-246-2002 to join our conversation with Softar Khwaja, president of the Pittsburgh chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations. 412-246-2002. Email ESSPGH at WESA.FM. On Twitter at ESSPGH. Let's go to the phones, and we'll start with Craig in Northside, who's been waiting for quite some time. Craig, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. You're on with Softar Khwaja.
Hello. Yes, I really appreciate this wonderful article he wrote. I have shared it on Facebook as well as in a letter to the President of the United States at the White House. And my concern is I would love to get a movement going to have the president and the news media in this country not use the terms ISIS or ISIL, because as the topic of the piece explains, they are not a state, they are not Islamic, and we should call them Daesh that many of our allies call them. And I'll leave this to you, but I really think that we should have a movement to stop calling them an Islamic state.
Well, it's an interesting point, Craig, and I would like to have you, Softar, clarify the term Daesh. Secretary of State John Kerry has been calling them Daesh, ISIS, by that name. It's a local Arabic acronym for ISIS. Explain this and where this term comes from.
Yeah, this is primarily semantics, and it is meant to deny the so-called Islamic credence that ISIS claims. Daesh is the alphabet, Dal, Aleph, and Sheen, which is the four letters of the Islamic State of Iraq and Sham. When that acronym was constructed, it remarkably matches two, Daesh and Daesh, two different Arabic words. One says you're sowing discord, and the other is that you should be crushed underfoot. And those are both character slights in the vernacular. So a number of people picked up on that. Instead of continuing to call them IS or ISIS, it gives them some grandiose perception of themselves, helps in their recruiting. It is counterproductive. So let's call them, short of calling them a swear word, which then we would not be any more civilized than others if you're resorting to swear words. But so that is the origin. The important thing is that, yes, there needs to be a Congress of people who get together and come up with a counter messaging, as well as consensus building to defeat these bizarre and totally barbaric interpretations that these folks have come up with. And we can talk more on that subject. Yeah.
And there is a Twitter comment coming in from Tim on Twitter. Tim on Twitter says, in response to why Pittsburgh hasn't had many issues with hate against the Muslim community, we have good leaders, many tolerant people, and enough nations represented by our universities to know that a backlash has no place here. And that is in response to your saying that Pittsburgh has, that the backlash here has been little to none.
Yes, and
that's Muslim community.
That's a big credit to our city. The educational culture, there are so many universities, there are so many hospitals, the caring culture. You know, one in 10 doctors nationwide are Muslims in this country. And that ratio is represented in Pittsburgh also. The university culture of understanding knowledge, and the hardworking culture of a steel town and an industrial town, that culture pervades. People work hard, and they are understanding, and they are faithful. So that forms a powerful nucleus. So Pittsburgh can be a beacon of understanding and knowledge, and not the reactionary we see in certain cities.
Let's take a call from Taylor in the South Hills on 412-246-2002. Hi, Taylor. You're on Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. What I wanted to know is, for someone like me who may not know someone of the Muslim faith personally, what is the best way to not only educate myself, but respond in a positive and meaningful way to all of the negativity that's being plastered all over the mainstream media?
It's a good question.
Yeah, first I would say I really appreciate your desire to seek more knowledge and more understanding, and that speaks to our culture here. I would say gather as many friends and acquaintances that you can, and go visit some Muslims. Start with the nearest mosque. The nearest one to the studio is the mosque in Oakland on Bigelow Boulevard. Go there. There are good people there. There are five mosques in the city of Pittsburgh region. There are at least nine official mosques, meaning they have a building that they can call a mosque, and there are a few unofficial ones. Go and visit them and spend time with them. Get to understand. Dig deep. The superficial things don't get you very far. Sometimes people go to a Muslim learning place and they learn about the five pillars and the basic practices, but those are practices. They are not the essence and the core of the faith. It's the aspect of mercy. It's the aspect of gaining knowledge. It's the aspect of respecting all of humanity as God's creations, and the sanctity of life, the sanctity of your environment, the sanctity of the place that you live, the earth. So people who just jump out and want to violate all these things, we need to work together to isolate these deviant thoughts and put them in their respective place. If they are a minority, they should stay a minority. We should not give them a huge voice by like some of the groups say, well, these extremists, they represent all of Islam. That is so counterproductive. That is unimaginable.
You say some American politicians, and certainly we heard an example of that last night, and as well as a few American journalists, are granting ISIS religious legitimacy. How are they doing this? And this kind of speaks to what Taylor was just talking about, that you know, you hear so much negativity in the media that she's wondering how to separate the distortions and those distortions that the media might be buying into from the truth about the essence of Islam.
Yeah, when there's a very loud and shouting conversation, the essence never surfaces. You're only trading sound bites, and it's a shouting match. So some of the politicians, they continue to insist, why is President Obama not calling ISIS as radical Islamic terrorism? Well, there is a reason for it. President Obama and the administration and Secretary of State John Kerry do not want to sanctify or grant a glorious status to the Daesh people, the ISIS people. They don't want to grant them that because a lot of the neighbors around ISIS don't want to. So when our politicians continue to hammer that this is Islam, they represent Islam, they're giving them a status that they don't deserve. And also these same politicians don't want to listen to Muslims who are faithful, who are law-abiding, and they are fully law-abiding under the Constitution and the laws of the United States. And this bugaboo of Sharia that people keep bringing up, Sharia tells these people that you live in a place, you have to observe the laws, you have to respect the laws, no questions. If you sign a document that I'm going to be getting a visa, I'm getting a green card, or I'm getting a citizenship, that is an oath. That oath is a covenant. You cannot violate the oath. If you're not comfortable taking that oath, do not take that oath. But once you take that oath, Sharia tells them you must abide by and be faithful to the oath that you took. So this becomes a very strange argument. You know, let me jump into saying a few things, because this is a nagging question that Donald Trump brought up last night, that there are so many people who want Sharia. This is horrible. This is treason, etc. Sharia has three basic parts. One part is your personal belief, your personal conduct, what food you eat, how you pray, how you clean yourself, how you clean your soul. You don't have bad thoughts, etc. That is the personal part of Sharia. That survives in any environment that you go to. Our Constitution here guarantees the free practice of your personal faith. The second part of Sharia is the interpersonal conduct and the economic and civil conduct, the transactions, etc. So there is there's that part of Sharia which is centuries old, has not been updated. But more importantly, if you live in a place where there are laws that you sign up to, then those laws supersede anything you had from a basic law in Sharia. So if you live here, you have to abide by all the civil laws. So that is Sharia. Abiding by the laws is compliant with Sharia. And the third part is the
law is in the laws of the United States.
Exactly. The civil laws. Then there's criminal laws, which is what Donald Trump was mentioning. Criminal laws is the third part. And if you're living in a land which has criminal laws and you have taken up citizenship and you've taken up residence in that land, by Sharia, you're required to comply with those laws. You cannot bring in laws from some other place. So if people are compliant with Sharia, it only leaves the personal part of your faith, the very personal part. Everything else that is regulated by law, you are required by Sharia to abide by that law and be fully faithful to it. So this bugaboo is being raised by a lot of hate groups as if Sharia means people will start behaving like the Stone Age. They'll have to stone each other. They have to, hang each other or flog each other. This is just makes absolutely no sense. But that's what I mentioned. People have to go and dig deep and understand what this really is, and they will find out, we were just afraid of how an ancient dictatorship in some part of the Middle East is practicing their version of Sharia from 400 or 500 years ago. And they, in quite honestly, they haven't updated Sharia of their own, the laws of their own, to be compliant with modern society. I mean, the societies and specifically after the Industrial Revolution, the world has changed quite a bit, and they have not really complied with it.
We're talking with Safdar Khawaja. He's president of the Pittsburgh chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations. 412-246-2002 is the number to call to join the conversation again. 412-246-2002. We had a call from Susan in Mount Lebanon who did not want to go on the air, but had a couple of questions. One was, how do you reconcile Muslim belief with Western stances on homosexuality and the ability to change your religion?
Most importantly, changing your religion. In Islam, there is no compulsion of faith. In Islam, we understand that it is not just Muslims who are totally observant and pure and pious that they are going to heaven. Anybody else can go to heaven. So even a pagan can go to heaven. There's deviant interpretations that only a certain creed will go to heaven and nobody else. And those are all deviants. They are not supported by the basic texts and the basic scriptures. So that is the biggest thing. There have been when the Muslims were heavily observant in Spain for 700-800 years, they were the most tolerant and open society mankind had known till that time. And other parts of the world also, they have been that way. This phenomenon of hateful interpretations of dismissing everybody else, this is only a few centuries old. And we can discuss that. It's a very long discussion. But this is only a few centuries old. Yeah.
And the second part of her question, ISIS claims that they are just doing what Muhammad did back in the past. What is his response? And again, that's from Susan in Mount Lebanon. What is your response?
Yes.
Is what she's asking.
My response is it is completely false. What they claim to be doing as following the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, is flat out false. For a detailed technical answer, I would say go to www.lettertobaghdadi.com. And there are clean references to why these people are flat out wrong in sort of claiming that they're following an ancient practice.
As you pointed out in your op-ed piece, it is, in fact, Muslims who should feel most aggrieved by ISIS because they make up the vast majority of ISIS victims, and it is their faith that ISIS is corrupting.
Absolutely true. And that means that we cannot just condemn them. We cannot just dissociate from them, saying, hey, I'm part of the ostrich brigade. I just don't want to deal with these people. Go away, and you're not one of us. we actually have to take actions, and a lot of actions. And only by these actions, you know, the silent people, a billion plus silent people, even if they start whispering, it turns into a roar, because if it happens on a very large scale, and that mobilization has to occur. And it is most likely going to occur. What Muslims actually ask for is, don't enable the dark side. For example, if there's billions of dollars of funding going to a certain group which is espousing hatred against the rest of humanity, we need to find a way to get the civilized people together to stop feeding the monster that is doing that. I do understand freedom of speech comes into play and civil liberties come into play. But when you are faced with threats on a global scale, people have to sit down with full understanding instead of reacting very rapidly and say, all right, who are the people who are accommodating, who want to live in this global village of humans in a harmonious fashion? And who are the people who just hate everybody? Do we want to give those hateful people lots of, I'm not saying directly, but you know, when a lot of money goes to a certain dictator, you don't know where that money is going after that point. And if it goes into the hands of extremists, they are empowered. They have so much social media presence. They are so extreme. We have to find ways to stop it. So Muslims have to be part of the solution. They have to take a leadership position in finding solutions. And there are multiple steps to getting to these solutions.
It's Essential Pittsburgh, and my guest is Safdar Khwaja. He's president of the Pittsburgh chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, talking about the tensions that exist throughout the United States, particularly the fuel that has been added to that tension by the comments of Donald Trump, the leading Republican candidate for president, and what the climate is like for Muslim Americans in the Pittsburgh community. You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002 with your comments and questions. And Safdar Khwaja, you say that there should be a powerful counter message to the warped worldview of ISIS. What should it be, and how do you make it work? How do you counter the message?
The first thing is, Paul, that a forceful counter narrative to what ISIS or Daesh that they are saying. And this is not new. Al Qaeda was saying similar things. And there was a, starting from the early parts of the 20th century, there was a so-called weaponization of religion that occurred. The king, who became king later, used people who had a certain aspect of very, very harsh and very strict and very, closed form of faith. He weaponized those people originally, and that's how he got control of the entire Arabian Peninsula. The British government supported him. He became king, etc. Those people still survive, and they are fed a huge amount of money every year. And that has to be de-weaponized. Most recently against the USSR, when these mujahideen who were cultivated, President Reagan was very supportive of the mujahideen, that these people are going to fight the USSR. But we didn't realize what really was happening at the mental level, what kind of mental modification, mind-changing techniques that were being used, how these people were turned into, I would call it, people without a soul who would not even understand that a fellow human is a fellow human. They were weaponized. Suicide bombing is also a very recent creation. It essentially didn't exist more than 100 years ago. And in fact, it started a manifestation 50 years ago or more recently.
Where does the idea come from that what I've heard said is that it's difficult to stop people, it might have been the president who said it, who are willing to die, who are, and there's this belief among the suicide bombers, the people that know that they're going to be killed in the crossfire when they engage in gun violence, that I will be rewarded there's some sort of afterlife reward. Where does that come from? Is that derived from some aspect of Islam?
That's part of the weaponization. That is part of the weaponization of people's religious feelings. And this is not new. This politicians have been using people for political purposes, religious people for political purposes for centuries. And
but there's this idea that you're going to have, and I'm just kind of moving this along because we're getting short on time, and
yeah,
I want to get to some calls. But there's this idea that there's this reward, and that this, and then in the meantime, you're really going to enjoy doing this, and you, this is a worthy sacrifice.
Yeah.
So it's this intoxicating message for people, and ISIS. And elements of ISIS are very capable users of social media to get their message out. So again, how do you counter the message? What do you do to tell people, hey, this, you are not being told the truth here, and you need to figure it out?
Yeah, the machinery that creates these distortions, their message about getting rewards is flat out nonsensical. There is absolutely not a single scholar who will stand in daylight who will support that. People who hide in dark places will. But to the youth, there has to be a message from fundamentals that, okay, you saw this event. These people are actually going to hell. They're not going to any reward. And these messages have to be powerful, and they have to be delivered at every possible location that youth can be influenced.
So on social media, on the internet.
On social media, in
Facebook.
In schools. In curriculums, people have to be taught that. That's one of the things that President Obama mentioned that we have to do. We can fight out ISIS and they will disappear, let's say like Al-Qaeda, but because that machinery exists, our intelligence people know where that machinery is. And we have to go smartly, attack that, not just physically, but also with a moral message, with a counter message that can actually stick. Now, psychologists need to get involved in how do we do this. First, we have to figure out what are we fighting, messages.
You say American Muslims can be uniquely useful in identifying religious websites that, for example, that subvert vulnerable minds.
Exactly. So a learned scholar can identify them, because if you have a minimally trained officer in law enforcement, that person will not be able to tell that, wait a minute, this message is leading down a slope which will lead to radicalization and this person losing all desire to preserve his own life. And then we can use him to take the lives of other people. There's a lot of psychological operations that take place in this. And Muslims can be part of that and bring a valuable contribution to that messaging.
And
to be spread.
And you say American Muslim scholars could assist security agencies. The question keeps coming up of how do we vet the refugees, for example, that this would be one way to do that.
They are using many mechanisms to vet them. There are people who are trained to do the vetting process. But you can add one more dimension to the vetting process to figure out, from basics, is this person being taken to the dark side? And is this person potentially hiding it or whatever? But a scholar can figure that out and identify that, and that would be a service.
Let's take a call from John in Franklin Park at 412-246-2002. Hi, John. You're on with Softar Khawaja.
Hello. My comment is as follows. Your guest suggested that non-Muslims would get a group together and go to a mosque and learn about the religion and what's fact and what is distorted. My comment is that many people don't even know a Muslim in terms of interacting with them. I think his idea is great, but I think it should be the Muslim community offering at certain locations or destinations the availability of non-Muslims to learn about the religion, and that may take place at a Muslim church, or it may take place in a neutral area.
Okay. John, let me jump in. What Softar is saying is certainly that he has urged people to visit a mosque. John says maybe there's another location other than a mosque where someone could go to, if for whatever reason they didn't want to go to a mosque, where they could go to learn more or engage in conversation, ask questions, as John was just doing. What are your thoughts about that, Softar?
Those are excellent thoughts. In order to get people to understand Muslims should be able to go everywhere. We are willing to go to City Hall if that is the proper forum. Any other place somebody else chooses. Let's say if you gather some people and say, here's a group of people and we want you to come and tell us about what Islam is. We are not comfortable going to the mosque, which is fine. Come to our fire hall or come to our some neutral place. We'd be glad to do that. You can search all the mosques in Pittsburgh on the internet. They're all visible. They have individual websites. You can call their public relations outreach coordinator and say, we need you to come to our county fair or to our flea market. We want you to talk about this. And yes, Muslims need to get out and broadcast what is the truth and what is not, because these people at ISIS, they're blowing all the media away. And we are feeling like we need to get out and do much more to be understood and also be part of the solution.
Mike on Twitter asks, and we're not going to have enough time to answer this, but he said he would like you to explain the differences of different branches of Islam, Sunni, Shia, and others. He's wondering how this split occurred. And since we don't have time for you to answer that, where could he go to research that, find an answer to that?
You could go to any of the Islamic Center websites. You can search on the internet. The splits occurred, centuries ago. But in all the core essential fundamentals, those people don't differ. They differ on superficial things.
And how should, we've only got about 10 seconds, but how should Muslims feel about their place in America and in Pittsburgh?
They should feel confident. They should feel welcome. And they should feel like they're real citizens of America.
Safdar Khawaja is the president of the Pittsburgh chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations. Thank you for being with us for this hour of Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Tomorrow, Mayor Perdudo makes his monthly visit on the program. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.